You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is March 29th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, we'll be welcoming Jeff Bryant from the Campaign for America's Future, who will be talking to us about education, the school reform movement that is buying its way through our country as we speak. Also on the program in just moments from now, Wes in Japan will be joining us, otherwise known as Wes Cheek. He will be calling us from northern Japan as he treks through the northern part of that country, surveying the absolute destruction in the wake, I guess literal and figurative, of the tsunami and earthquake in northern Japan. President Obama giving his much-awaited, my opinion, long-overdue speech on a rationale for our intervention in Libya, our war, whatever you want to call it. Important, I guess, to the extent that we should have gotten some type of congressional authorization, despite the fact that on March 1st, the Senate passed a non-binding resolution to support a no-fly zone there. Again, you know, this is a very tough call for me. You know where I land on this, and I do it with a lot of reservations. All right, here's we got Wes now. So let's take Wes, and we'll talk about Libya in just a moment. Wes, are you there? Wes?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Hey, welcome to the program. It's Wes Cheek. He is. You can reach him at Wes in Japan on Twitter, or check out his blog at spacetravelsacrime.com. So, Wes, where are you now?
I'm in the same place that I was when I talked to you yesterday. I'm coming back into Iwate-ken. I should explain to people, sorry, I'm kind of vague on where we are. There's Iwate Prefecture and Miyagi Prefecture, kind of the most affected areas, and I'm staying in Iwate, kind of an hour back from the disaster area, so that I can use the internet and have power to do this, and then driving in every day to Miyagi Prefecture to kind of check out the damage and talk to people.
So what have you seen?
Well, today I went a little further south than we did yesterday because, you know, just no matter where you go, there's just so much to see. So we have to, like, promise ourselves every day that we're going to go a little bit further. If we stop once, we're going to end up just talking to people for a while. So today we drove a little further south, and we stopped at there was a Shinto shrine that was all torn up. So we thought, well, that might be interesting. So we went there, and there was a family walking around inside it, and it was a dad and his two daughters, and I think their cousins. And he owned a sake distribution center, maybe, or maybe it was just a liquor shop. And all of it was just ruined, and their house was on top of it, and it was ruined. But they were kind of searching through the wreckage for bottles of sake that had been lost because he wanted to give them to the fire department because they'd been working so hard. But the great part was his kids were just so positive. They were having so much fun running around looking for bottles in the wreckage. So I saw that today. I saw, you know, the further you go south, the damage just gets worse and worse. Like, we say every time, Ethan, the photographer I'm traveling with, every time we kind of say, well, it can't get any worse, and then you go over the next hill, and it's just worse and worse and worse. And we finished the day finally making it to Minami Sanriku, which has been on all the news, and it's just devastation like you can't believe. It looks like the Full Metal Jacket when they're fighting through Wei, to, like, when they have the sniper after them. It looks like that, but just a whole city of that.
Right. And so you mentioned to me in an email that you got to sit down, I guess, yesterday. People should understand that it's about midnight your time. Is that right?
Yeah, it's 12:40 here.
And that yesterday you had an opportunity to sit down with government officials and the Fishermen's Union. Tell me about that.
Right. That was really interesting. I think that was the day before. That was on Sunday. And we were down photographing the port, which I think a lot of people have seen the port on television. It was the one that was on fire with boats on fire, all the boats in the parking lot. And an older man kind of walked up to me and asked me, like, where I was from. And I asked him if I could talk to him. And he said, I'll talk to you if you can give me a ride. I have to get to a meeting, and I don't have a car. So I said, okay, get in the car. And we drove to this meeting. It turns out he's Mr. Sato. He's the president of the Fishermen's Union in Kesennuma. And so I drove him to this meeting, and I was like, well, who's going to be at the meeting? And he said, well, you know, some important people. And it ended up it was him and the mayor and, like, the heads of all the fishery were meeting with officials from Tokyo, the former Mr. Yamada, who's the former agricultural secretary, and agricultural secretary is also in charge of fishing. And it was a pretty it got a little bit heated, the meeting, because the people from the government, and also people from the prefectural government, were assuring the fishermen that everything would get up and running again. And the fishermen just kept asking, like that's really easy for you to say, and then you're going to leave, and nothing's going to happen. And the government officials and the mayor were trying to kind of smooth that over, but the fishermen were saying, like, we have to deal with reality. If our port's not open for the next few months, all our business is going to go to Korea and Taiwan and China and domestic ports, and we're going to lose out. Our time's going to pass, and it's going to be done.
And what is their response? I mean, I would imagine that, you know, getting a port built up is got to be low on the list of priorities at this point.
I don't know. You know, it's hard to know. Like, one kind of impression I'm getting is people just don't really know what the national government's going to do. And even, you know, my father's a fisherman also, so I really feel for these fishermen, but I don't know how you get the port up and running in 2 months. The government's saying June, and June seems fast to me looking at it because it's ruined. But they said that they've cleared a channel. They have an emergency channel so boats can get out. And out of, I'm not so clear on the numbers because they said a few different numbers, there was out of a fleet of about 70 fishing vessels, they have 18 left. But the president of the union brought up a good point. He said that, you know, everyone in town starting, or a lot of people in town are starting over from zero, but a lot of fishermen are starting over from less than zero because they're already in debt over their boats and supplies and fuel. So he was asking the government, what are we going to do about the people starting over from less than zero? Are you going to cut their debts or not? And there was never really a firm answer on that. The people from the government, especially Mr. Yamada, just said that there's no way that I would tell you that we can do something that we can't. And then everyone kind of just sighed and said, but, you know, the government always says that, and it's going to be a few months from now, and nothing's going to happen. So we'll see how that works out.
And what else? Do you have anything else that really struck you over the past day?
Well, today, you know, today I've been pretty good about being stoic about this because you're just looking on just devastation. There's no other word for it. And, you know, you're looking at where, like, people lost their lives. They've not lost everything that they own. And, like, today I kind of finally hit that, like, one moment where it was like, wow, this is nothing that you can be prepared for as a human. We're in Minami Sanriku in a town, I think it's called Shizugawa. And it was noticeable for most places we've been, there's been people in the wreckage, and I've gone up and talked to them, and there's been people kind of looking for stuff, and we have a conversation. Here, there was just nobody. There's nobody except for, like, the self-defense force troops, like, cleaning stuff up. And I climbed up to the top of this hill, and it's nowhere you think water could reach. It's, like, 60 feet above the ground. I'm pretty sure it's that high. It's really, really high. And on top of it, there's a tsunami evacuation park. This is a designated tsunami evacuation center. and I walked up to it to take some pictures, and I noticed the ground there was covered in kind of this mud, too. And so the wave must have reached there. And there was kind of a higher berm in the middle of the park, and I kind of went up to the top of it to see what I could see, and behind it was a preschool. And the preschool, you know, it wasn't damaged. I don't think anyone, I mean, it was damaged, like a little water damage. It wasn't anything bad. But, I mean, anyone with, like, kids or who works with kids or anybody who's a human, you look at that and just think what those people had to go through, thinking, here we are safe on this hill, and lots of people weren't. So, I don't know. I say this every time, but it's just hard to convey, like, how absolute the damage is.
Are you seeing any foreign NGO types, or is it all everybody you're seeing are basically Japanese military?
Yeah,
defense
I'm not
forces?
Sure. Like, I watch on TV here, and I see lots of foreign aides. So I know they're here. Like, I really don't want to like say that they're not here. I just don't see them, and I think we've been covering a lot of the more rural areas because I just kind of get in the car and drive down the beach and take like whatever little roads there and just talk to whoever looks interesting. And I've run into, not only have I not run into any foreign aid, I haven't run into any domestic aid. And that's not saying that they aren't working places, because I hear about them and you know, shelter boxes on TV again tonight, and I know there's people doing a lot of work. I just haven't run into it. It's just the area is vast, the damage area. So I think out in the rural areas there's not so much aid. But one there has been a large presence today with JA. It's like the large Japanese agricultural association. It's like non-governmental, I believe it's like a union. It was very, very powerful in Japan, and they had representatives going around and checking on people and seeing what they could do. And one last quick story I'll tell you real quick was about JA, which is a JA affiliated gas station that just opened in September, and it was completely wiped out in the tidal wave. There's like a 18-wheeler through their roof. But they had it open today, and they were operating it by a machine that you pedal like a bicycle, and it pumps the gas out of a can. Hmm. And this was their last day. They were open until 2 o'clock today. So I went and got a tank of gas from them. And they were all pretty good. Like a bunch of 22-year-old guys that were saying, man, this is the worst thing in the world to be famous for. Can't we be famous for something else?
All right. Well, Wes, thanks so much for checking in with us. We will check in with you tomorrow again if you
okay.
are able. And
I'll be able.
And folks, again, you can follow Wes on Wes Creek on his Twitter feed at Wes in Japan, and check out Space Travels A Crime. Thanks so much for joining us, Wes.
All right. Thanks, man.
I'll right, we'll talk to you soon. And so that's our daily update from Wes Cheek, who is traveling through northern Japan. Now, just want to spend a couple minutes on what Obama had to say about Libya last night. Here he is explaining why Libya.
America cannot use our military wherever repression occurs. And given the costs and risks of intervention, we must always measure our interests against the need for action. But that cannot be an argument for never acting on behalf of what's right. In this particular country, Libya, at this particular moment, we were faced with the prospect of violence on a horrific scale. We had a unique ability to stop that violence, an international mandate for action, a broad coalition prepared to join us, the support of Arab countries, and a plea for help from the Libyan people themselves. We also have the ability to stop Gaddafi's forces in their tracks without putting American troops on the ground. To brush aside America's responsibility as a leader, and more profoundly, our responsibilities to our fellow human beings under such circumstances, would have been a betrayal of who we are. Some nations may be able to turn a blind eye to atrocities in other countries. The United States of America is different.
Well, so there it is. I mean, one part moral argument, one part American exceptionalism. And again, you know, I think there is real reason to be concerned that we may be superseding the UN mandate here, but within that narrow context, I frankly am, like I say, with grave reservations supporting this action. Now, it also remains to be seen, and listener Ian has been sending me these stories about Mahmoud Jibril, a story in the the Boston Globe, sort of the head, I guess, or a member of a 31-person council coordinating Libya's opposition. This guy is sort of an interesting character, and I think there is some reason to believe that there is, you know, this is their version of the Iraqi Liberation Congress or whatever it was, that Shalabi outfit. Now, I'm not suggesting this guy is working for some other entity like Shalabi was. But I mean, there's certainly reasons to be concerned here. And when you look at our inaction in regards to the Ivory Coast, when you look at our less than inaction in terms of Bahrain or Yemen, there is every reason to be skeptical of this. We should always be skeptical of any use of American military force. And really, the question as to whether or not we have stayed within this UN mandate, I think time will tell in the coming days. But clearly, I think Obama should have gone to Congress for some greater authorization before this. But again, I am happy that the UN is in some way being put into the position of being the arbiter as to whether or not this type of mission is just and certainly legal. And with all that said, Rachel did a good job of comparing Obama's speech last night with his Nobel Peace Prize acceptance from 2009. Let's play the Nobel Peace acceptance speech right now.
More and more, we all confront difficult questions about how to prevent the slaughter of civilians by their own government, or to stop a civil war whose violence and suffering can engulf an entire region. I believe that force can be justified on humanitarian grounds, as it was in the Balkans or in other places that have been scarred by war. Inaction tears at our conscience and can lead to more costly intervention later. And that's why all responsible nations must embrace the role that militaries with a clear mandate can play to keep the peace. America's commitment to global security will never waver, but in a world in which threats are more diffuse and missions more complex, America cannot act alone.
And let's just listen to 18 seconds of his speech last night again, and then we will take a break and speak to Jeff Bryant from Campaign for America's
Future.
Okay, let's go.
We know that the United States, as the world's most powerful nation, will often be called upon to help. In such cases, we should not be afraid to act. But the burden of action should not be America's alone.
And there you have it. We're done. We're doing this under the mandate and the auspices of the UN. And, of course, now military operations have been handed over to NATO. Now, of course, we are half of NATO, I guess, at the end of the day, in terms of actual military personnel and funding and whatnot. But it's clear this is not a unilateral jaunt. After that, things become a lot more murky. Let's turn to education. We'll be back in just a moment with Jeff Bryant from the Campaign for America's Future. Hi, folks. You can always support the show and get great coffee, tea, or chocolate by going to justcoffee.coop. Putting the coupon code MAJORITY in the coupon box, get a 10% discount, get some great fair trade coffee. And, of course, the real way that this show is going to be able to continue is if you become a member now. You can do so at majority.fm. You get almost an hour of extra daily show, plus some swag, plus knowing that you're supporting independent media. Thanks. Oh, yeah. On the phone, folks, we have Jeff Bryant from the Campaign for America's Future. Welcome to the program, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Now, I want to talk to you a couple of things. Why don't we start in general with this whole notion, and you just had a post up about this, I guess it was yesterday, about just the whole notion of this education reform movement. I mean, we see it in terms of what, you know, Bill Gates is pouring millions upon millions of dollars into this so-called reform movement. We see movies like Waiting for Superman and The Lottery, which I found to be very well-crafted pieces of propaganda that left out a big part of the story from my perspective. As part of this movement, this reform movement includes so-called progressive, you know, and liberals. But it seems to be there is one sort of consistent factor that involves really wealthy people.
Yes.
Is that accurate? Yeah. Tell me more about this movement.
Well, the term reform altogether is a misnomer. This is actually an entrenched, fairly status quo idea that has developed for a long time and has actually been, in fact, since 2001 and No Child Left Behind, the law of the land. It came from, like, where a lot of bad ideas come from. It came from bipartisanship. There was a consensus that emerged during the Reagan years among centrist Democrats and right-wing Republicans that schools needed to operate on a more of a market-based and business approach, that teachers in schools needed to be incentivized and or punished in order to do the right thing by school kids, that teachers had to be more efficient. We had to cut down on the costs of what it takes to educate a child. The crowning glory of this, of course, was No Child Left Behind, which was created in the Bush administration, Bush 2. And what has been to great dismay to many Democrats, and particularly those who know about education and are involved in education, is that the Obama administration is, instead of turning back that narrative and turning back that legislation, they're actually prolonging it, in some cases making it even worse, through punitive programs like Race to the Top, which doles out money for schools based on whether or not they bend to the coercion of things like adding on charter schools and making teachers pay based on student test scores, things like that. And so the point that you bring up about it being financed significantly by extremely wealthy people, not only Bill Gates, but also the Broad Foundation, the Walton Foundation of Walmart fame, and other huge Wall Street-based organizations. Not only is it backed by extremely wealthy people, it's being enacted by very powerful people in Washington, D.C., even though a lot of, I guess what you'd call little people out there who are teachers and parents, actually think a lot of these ideas being pushed on them are very bad ideas.
Yeah, let's talk about this. I mean, you know, I imagine that Bill Gates' agenda is, you know, I'm just going to give him the benefit of the doubt here that his agenda is a good one. Obviously, I mean, I can't imagine he's spending all this money because he doesn't want children to be educated. But it also is, I think, to a certain extent, maybe a function of, you know, one of those, and it's maybe the third time I've said it this week, but when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And, you know, it's one thing to impose these type of benchmarks are a lot easier when you're selling a software product or when you can do testing on a software product. But when we're talking about how the process of educating our children, it's just not. It just doesn't work out that it is so convenient that you can measure it in such black and white terms. Is that right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Regarding intentions, I think that many of the Democratic leaders who were part of the agreement about No Child Left Behind, I think that a lot of their intentions were that this was going to be legislation that would help poor kids. And because that was initially how it was rolled out. It was rolled out as a way to close achievement gaps in what's widespread in America's schools. And I think Bill Gates probably has the same intentions. However, what people don't understand very well about education is that it is a fundamentally democratic process. And when you get a top-down mandate, when you get people with such power, they tend not to listen to anybody else. They think that they have the idea that works best. For instance, Bill Gates' first venture into saving America's schools, it's how he would probably put it, was a venture called Small Schools, which he rolled out significantly in New York City school districts. And it was based on some good research that maybe the size of schools could be a significant factor. But however, the way it was rolled out was incredibly disruptive to families and children in New York City. Schools were just, by wholesale means, taken apart and reduced to small schools, or their campuses were altered in other very significant ways. And after a while, I think after about $1 billion of expenditure on Bill Gates' part, the whole attempt was abandoned. Now, Mr. Gates has another idea that if we just incentivize teachers to push better test-taking skills and get their students to do better on standardized tests, then that will produce better achievement overall. And I think that that is also a fundamentally wrong idea for the very same reason that you suggested, is that you can't really measure learning by standardized tests. It's a very, very inaccurate and very poor measurement of learning. Learning is actually a lot more complex than that.
All right. Well, let's talk about the one of the problems with standardized tests, among the many of them, is that you know, for instance, you're trying to measure how a school is performing, but it doesn't take into account that, you know, there are a lot of schools, particularly poor schools, particularly schools in different regions of the country that traditionally are not doing so well. Part of the reason is because you got such high turnover of students. Parents are moving because they got to find a different job. And so it's very hard to account for how a school is doing because there's such a high turnover of students. But another thing that has come out this week is this story of Michelle Ray and the education system in D.C., which Michelle Ray was one of these superstars of the so-called reform movement, by showing that if you came in, you fired a bunch of teachers, and you stringently applied standardized testing, you can raise the achievement of schools. And now it turns out that may have been a bit illusory.
Yes. I think, first of all, in regards to standardized tests as effective measurement of schools, there are, as I said, many particular problems with it. And one is that, as you've mentioned, there are a lot of factors outside of the school that, outside of the school's control that affect, how well a student does on a test. Poverty, for instance, high rates of poverty have a very strong correlation with poor performance on standardized tests. Problems with nutrition, obviously, if a kid is malnourished, or if he's sick, if he's got a toothache, he's not going to do well on test day. There are also, you mentioned rapid turnover in of student population, which can be as high as 50% in urban districts. There are also big problems with teachers coming and going and with staff specialists coming in and out. And actually, what's going on right now is we are increasing those problems by these huge firings and layoffs of teachers that are rolling across the country. And you bring up Michelle Ray's problem. It is the probably poster person of what's wrong with using standardized tests. There is a well-known law called Campbell's Law, used among sociologists, who understand that once you start to correlate success or effectiveness with a particular metric, in this case, test scores, you are bound to engineer the system into everything going toward that metric. In this case, there was widespread cheating in order to try to push test scores up. Eight of the 10 schools that were cited were schools that Michelle Ray had given an award to for being the top performing schools. And there's no doubt that those schools were pushing for that award. They knew it meant more money for them. It meant better pay for the teachers. And so they distorted their whole entire practice in order to achieve those results on the tests. It would be like, for instance, paying cops by how many specific arrests they make. What's going to happen is the policeman is going to make more arrests, even though a lot of them, when they go into court, will be unsubstantial and quickly turned away. So these kinds of ways of measuring public programs like education just don't work, and they're severely damaging to families and children.
And I want to get to what you perceive as a good way of doing this, and I want to talk about teacher hiring and firing too. But first, let's just touch on this issue of charter schools, which is promoted very heavily. As a parent of a New York public school student, I've seen we've had a charter school that just moved into our district, and it takes resources from a time where we had people who were worried about getting their kid into public school this year, and it sops. Resources. And, the idea theoretically is that these schools are supposed to admit anybody, but I keep hearing stories and stories about how troubled kids are basically shuttled outside of the school again to show that they get, that these schools are more successful at the end of the day. But there's no data to really show that on whole, charter schools are any more successful than public schools.
Yes, I have nothing against charter schools per se. The whole idea of charter schools came from Al Shanker, who was the head of the American Federation of Teachers, a union. A number of charters are teacher-led, union-created. I know personally of children that wouldn't have made it through high school if they hadn't gone to a charter school. So there's nothing per se wrong with charter schools, but here again you have to look at the bigger picture. You're absolutely correct that all the data from the most widespread studies shows the charter schools don't necessarily do any better and, in fact, may do worse in educating children. So right off the bat, charter schools are not a silver bullet. They're not a magic wand that's going to change education. Secondly, there are a lot of problematic aspects of charter schools that are emerging. For instance, you've brought up the one about high student attrition, where students that are the most difficult to educate, they get shuttled out and then always back into public schools. There was also widespread evidence that charter schools are less apt to have children who need special education services. They're less apt to serve children whose first language isn't English. Lots of issues like that. And then all you have to do is Google charter school and fraud, and you can see that there is also emerging widespread concerns that many of these charter organizations are boondoggles. In fact, the charter schools on average spend more money on administration. Many of their leaders make high six-figure salaries. These are things that wouldn't be allowed in a traditional public school, or they would certainly be a big problem. But because charter schools can often hide their books or operate under less disclosure than a traditional public school and certainly less regulation, they can get away with these things.
All right. So let me ask you, the broader question. I mean, you mentioned that, these top-down mandates don't work very well. I mean, are right-wingers right? Should we not have a Department of Education as part of the federal government?
Well, absolutely, the federal government has to have a role in public education. For instance, Brown versus Board of Education, which desegregated schools, was a landmark of federal intervention. We already have a problem in our society with schools becoming more segregated. They're more segregated now than they were 20 years ago, and we're starting to see big problems with what's called the school-to-prison pipeline, that it's being especially accelerated in student populations who are poor or who have a minority. And a lot of it has to do with policies that shut students out of programs based on their test scores or can oftentimes coerce them into dropping out altogether. So the federal government needs to have a role in education in order to continue to ensure that there's equity in the system. Title I, which is the funding that's used to make sure students in poor neighborhoods can get adequate facilities, is still a very viable and essential program. So there is an active role for the federal government in education, but what is being done is that they are mandating things that normally would be handled by local school boards. Local school boards, democratically elected officials across the country, have to represent their constituencies. The idea behind a lot of these reform ideas is that students and parents need to be treated as customers and not as stakeholders and constituents. And when you have that idea, you have a much less fundamentally democratic system. Just try getting anything out of AT&T. So we do need the federal government, but the federal government has to start enabling democratic movements in schools and not thwarting them.
So how would you go about measuring the quality of schools? I mean, if we wanted to increase the quality of education, obviously you have to analyze these schools, but would you even measure them on a scale, or would it be more like this is the weakness of this particular school, that's the weakness of that particular school? How would you go about it?
Well, we could look to models that are already working abroad. For instance, schools in countries like Finland, they don't have these grading systems and races to the tops and all these ratings that coerce schools into going after points and boosting test scores. What they do is they, first of all, have a very well-respected, well-prepared, and supported teaching force. And that's something that we don't have in this country, and it's getting worse because of a lot of these reform efforts that are bent on cutting teacher pay, cutting their tenure, making their positions less secure, and making them take on larger class sizes, and frankly do things that they think is not in their professional self-interest, or it goes against the rule of being a good educator. So we should look abroad for other ideas. We should use multiple measures, absolutely, to rate to evaluate schools and to evaluate teachers. As a matter of fact, when teachers are allowed to evaluate each other, they tend to be much harder on themselves than outside rating services. Teachers know which teacher in a school is not pulling the load because they end up with that teacher's kids next year. That's a big incentive for them to keep the teaching force highly professional. And also, yes, teachers need to be better paid. On an apples-to-apples comparison, teachers are paid much less than their educated peer group in the private sector.
All right. So lastly, let me just ask you this. I mean, what about the whole issue of how teachers' unions supposedly make it impossible to fire teachers? And, you know, and I know that even heads of teachers' unions have come out and have tried to create, you know, have suggested forms in which, ways in which the teachers' employ could be better handled. But give me your take on that.
Well, I think you can always find incidents of where teachers' unions have not acted in necessarily the best interest of children and parents. But for all of those incidents you can point to, you can certainly point to many other places where teachers' unions have been fundamentally critical to higher achievement. For instance, the most unionized states in America, such as Massachusetts, for instance, have students who consistently do the best on local, state, and international measurements of achievement. So the correlation of teachers' unions to failing schools or bad practice is extremely weak.
Right. And okay. All right. Well, you know, I appreciate it. I wish we had more time to talk about this, but we'll try this again. But Jeff Bryant from the Campaign for America's Future, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Sam. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye. No, more stories. We're going to stay. All right. So I got a couple more stories I want to do. First off, and then we're going to go to the post show. This is an important one, folks. Got this via Digby, but it's out there now. StrengthenSocialSecurity.org is starting their big push to make sure that Social Security is off the table when it comes to we're already seeing this. The Obama administration or the Democrats have made some deal where they're going to propose another $20 million of cuts. It's not enough for the Republicans. We are probably headed to a budget showdown, which would involve shutting down the government. I don't even agree with the notion of those 20 million cuts. We're going to talk more about this. I'm going to talk about it tomorrow, but I'm going to talk about it in the post show. There is more and more, evidence, just incredibly mounting evidence. And maybe it's not even that the evidence hasn't been there. I mean, you don't have to be a genius to find this stuff. It just needs to be reported that we are simply undertaxed in this country. That's it. That's the bottom line. By any measure, whether it's you want to do it to other industrialized nations or to our own nation, 50 years ago, we are grossly undertaxed. On the federal level, on the local level, we are grossly undertaxed. More than a third, sometimes in some cases a half of budget problems in states and on the federal level is specifically a function of what tax rate we pay. Not even talking about receipts going down because we're in the middle of a recession and there's less economic activity. I'm talking about specifically what percentage of our incomes do we pay in taxes. And as a way of mitigating the effects of lowered taxes, particularly on upper income brackets, $1 million or more. The plan by our plutocrats in Washington is to basically transfer wealth, transfer money that has been paid into the Social Security system by people who are not millionaires, and transfer that wealth to cover for the lack of taxation upon millionaires. I mean, it's a very simple equation. You're robbing Peter essentially to pay off Paul's debts. And in this case, wage earners are Peter and millionaires are Paul. And the debt being what they owe to society in the form of taxes to get the services and the social stability that they require to continue to make their money. So strengthensocialsecurity.org, don't like the name of it, but that's the name that has been chosen, because Social Security is fine. To the extent that it needs to be strengthened, it's only from the attacks from the establishment, from the wealthy establishment in this country. Call your senators at 1-866-251-2544. 866-251-2544. You'll be given a choice of your state's two senators to be connected with. Call both if you have the time. Tell them that you're a constituent of theirs, that you want to tell your senator to oppose all cuts in Social Security. And by that, you mean raising the retirement age, any decreases in and cost of living increases, any of it. And tell them to vote yes on the Bernie Sanders, Harry Reid Social Security Protection Amendment, which will raise the threshold needed in terms of votes to cut Social Security. The number again, 866-251-2544. We're going to head to the flip side. Tomorrow, we'll be talking to Jeff Cohen, formerly of FAIR. Is he formerly of FAIR? It's going to be a great talk. Very interesting guy. You can join me on the flip side. I will be taking... Oh, I forgot to turn on my IM thing. At Majority FM. Folks, where are your memberships? Are they sitting in your pocket? Are they lounging around your house? Are they hanging on your iPod? Are they embedded in your iTunes? You should send it to us. We need your memberships. And don't forget, justcoffee.coop, 10% off if you use the coupon code MAJORITY in the coupon code box. Until tomorrow, folks, or on the flip side, see you then.